safety checks, we do welfare checks, even suicide attempts, we do. We're on call 24/7.
The struggle continues in recruiting and retaining public safety officers in villages. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 9th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, new poll numbers show a tighter race for Alaska's lone U.S. House seat.
Certainly, Elise Galvin has put herself in position where it's possible that she may win.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. The Trust Fund Land Office annual fall sale is in full swing across Alaska. Revenue generated by the Trust Land Office helps fund local programs for local people. View parcels and learn more at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Two members of an Utqiagvik whaling crew have died, reportedly after a boat capsized during fall whaling. In a statement yesterday, North Slope Borough Mayor Harry K. Brower Jr. confirmed that two lives were lost and said that the borough is not releasing details about the incident until all the facts are gathered and all family members have been notified. On Facebook yesterday, members of the Utqiagvik community and others from around the state posted condolences, remembrances, and prayers for the whalers and their families. Over the past 2 years, public safety has been named the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's top priority by delegates for the Association of Village Council Presidents. At this year's annual AVCP convention in Bethel, a panel discussed how to recruit and retain village public safety officers. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was there and brings us this report.
This time last year, there were 8 village public safety officers across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Now, there are 9. One more is undergoing a background check as part of the application process. The region has 56 villages, and many don't have any law enforcement at all.
I feel that for me not to respond or other people to not respond is not caring.
Phyllis Ivan is president of the Lower Kalskag Tribal Council. In May, her community hired its first law enforcement officer in a long time, a tribal police officer. Before that, Ivan, along with fellow council members and community volunteers, were the ones responding to emergencies. Now, even with the TPO, Ivan remains on call.
Safety checks, we do welfare checks, even suicide attempts, we do. We're on call 24/7.
Lower Kalskag would prefer to have a VPSO. So would Kotlik. Delia Hunt is the Hamilton Tribal Administrator and says once Kotlik had an officer who was hired from the village, but other people in the community would pick on him or threaten his family. Now, there's no law enforcement in Kotlik, and the community's only recourse during dangerous situations is to go on lockdown until a trooper flies in from somewhere else. Jody Potts with the Tanana Chiefs Conference used to work as a VPSO and now serves on the Governor's Tribal Advisory Council.
A lot of locals don't want to do the job, so we have to hire people from outside, and they cannot live in a rural village on the wage that they make.
Potts participated in the Association of Village Council Presidents Public Safety Panel. The number of village public safety officers is at its lowest point, and Potts says the state already knows how to increase recruitment and retention.
Honestly, the state knows how to do it because they do it with the Alaska State Troopers to get them to go to the rural posts like Bethel, Kotzebue, St. Mary's. They give them a rural differential. So they get their base pay, they get their rural differential, and then they also get the overtime.
Under the Alaska Constitution, the state holds criminal jurisdiction across Alaska, but Potts sees rural communities receiving a lower standard of public safety than urban areas or communities on the road system. These rural communities are predominantly Alaska Native. Closing the gap, Potts thinks, will require the state legislature to not only provide more funding, but to change their attitude toward rural Alaska overall.
Getting them to believe in the program and believe that VPSOs deserve and villages deserve equal service is going to be a big challenge.
Alvin Jimmy coordinates the VPSO program for AVCP. He told the convention that the two main barriers for applicants in the region are drug use and criminal incidents on their records. Jimmy has been traveling the YK Delta surveying the public safety infrastructure across the region. In August, AVCP held a public safety summit with partners from across the state. One idea that arose was to have roving VPSOs that float throughout AVCP's 13 units. AVCP plans to release a regional public safety assessment later this year. The Association of Village Council Presidents would not permit its staff to be interviewed for this story. And this year, for the first time, AVCP would not allow KYUK to record any part of its annual convention. For more than a decade, KYUK has enjoyed providing sections of the convention to listeners who are unable to attend the event in Bethel. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A new poll suggests Alaska Congressman Don Young may be in a tight race. Alaska survey research shows challenger Elise Galvin is within 4 percentage points of Alaska's lone U.S. House member.
Certainly, Elise Galvin has put herself in position where it's possible that she may win.
Pollster Ivan Moore, though, points out that Young has been winning elections for 45 years.
For someone who's been reelected so many times, Don Young does fairly routinely get himself in fairly close races, or at least they appear close for a while.
Moore's survey, conducted in the first week of October, shows not quite 50% of respondents said they'd vote for Young. 46% said they'd vote for Galvin, even though nearly that many said they didn't know who she was. Moore says respondents who don't like Young may have been giving her the benefit of the doubt. Word of caution here, in 2008, a slew of polls, including Moore's, showed Ethan Berkowitz was going to beat Young. He didn't. Moore has a theory about that.
Maybe in polls, people flirt with the idea of dumping Don, but then when it comes to election day, they consider the upsides, his seniority, and so on.
The sample was 500 likely voters reached by cell and landline. Moore conducted it as part of a series funded by a group of clients that he says do not include candidates or political parties. A similar survey he conducted in late September showed Galvin behind by 11 points. Alaska Survey Research also released poll results yesterday on the race for governor. Republican Mike Dunleavy had a nearly 20-point lead over independent Governor Bill Walker. Democrat Mark Begich was third. The Republican Governors Association has paid more than $2.5 million to a group backing Dunleavy's campaign for governor. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman dug through the campaign finance reports.
The Republican Governors Association's contributions were the largest related to the campaign for governor made in the last 8 weeks. That's according to filings with the Alaska Public Offices Commission that were due on Friday. The RGA money has been paying for TV advertising through an Alaska group, Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy. More than 99% of the group's money has come from the RGA. Both the RGA and Families for Alaska's Future were fined last week for failing to register with the commission before the RGA started buying ads. Families for Alaska's Future and another group backing Dunleavy, Dunleavy for Alaska, have raised more than $3.5 million combined. Those totals are much more than the amounts raised by the group supporting the other candidates. Unite Alaska for Walker Malott has raised just under $1 million, and Begich for Alaska has raised $72,000. These groups are separate from the campaigns for the candidates. Of the candidates, Independent Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott have raised the most. The Republican Dunleavy and his running mate Kevin Meyer are second, and Democrat Mark Begich and running mate Deborah Call are third. The other major focus of campaign donations is ballot measure 1, the fish habitat protection measure. A group opposing the measure, Stand for Alaska, Vote No on 1, has raised $11.5 million. Yes for Salmon, Yes on 1 has raised much less, $1.3 million. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's largest city trying to become a greener city.
One of the things that we're doing is looking at ways that we can electrify our fleet and save energy and save money for the municipality.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
ConocoPhillips has reached a milestone at the first drill site on federal leases within the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The company announced Tuesday that it has produced its first oil at the Greater Moose's Tooth No. 1 drill site. Production began Friday. The site is a satellite of the Alpine field. Oil will be processed through existing facilities at Alpine. Construction at the site began in 2017, and Conoco says at its peak over two winters, it created 700 jobs. The site has a nearly 12-acre drilling pad. Production plans call for 9 initial wells with capacity for 33 wells. Peak gross production is estimated at 25,000 to 30,000 barrels of oil per day. The company estimates construction and drilling expenses at about $725 million. A major international body for assessing the science related to climate change released yet another dire report this week. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a special report that says, among other things, quote, "Limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society." The University of Alaska Fairbanks' Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says this report is particularly noteworthy.
The IPCC issues a big climate report every 5 or 6 years. But this is an interim report. It's a special report that looks at the amount of warming that we've already baked into the system and then what the near-term projections are. It uses 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is about 2.7 Fahrenheit, as this key threshold that anything, any warming that occurs above that is going to have really magnified consequences. And so it looks at where we're at now and what it would take to stay underneath that threshold. And the actions that are going to be required are going to be dramatic. We're talking in the next 2 decades, reducing global carbon emissions by 50%, and then in about 50 years, having zero carbon emissions.
And remind us why a degree or two of warming matters.
There's any number of consequences to warming a degree or two Celsius. Sea level rise, a meter of sea level rise might displace 100 or 200 or 300 million people. That's a lot of people. It might make countries that are agriculturally productive not productive. It might reduce our sea ice from, the current reduced state to a much lower baseline.
For people who have heard these dire climate reports for a while now, how does this one stand out, these projections in this report?
I think what this report really highlights, it talks about what the impacts are going to be, in if we warm another half degree, 1 degree, 1.5 degrees. But it really lays out a very detailed plan for how to avoid that. And so avoiding that would include tremendous reductions in carbon emissions. It would include changes in land use. It would include massive forest replanting to sequester carbon, even some geoengineering. It really kind of spells out the steps that would need to be taken to prevent this kind of runaway global warming.
Does the report have any sort of a take on how likely that is to happen?
It's always difficult to figure out, how people are going to respond to different situations. And so I would, not hazard to guess how our government or other governments or individuals would respond to this report. But it's intended to be a wake-up call that, we have extremely high confidence in many of the components of the climate system. It's basically middle school chemistry can demonstrate that adding greenhouse gases is going to warm the atmosphere. It's not very complicated.
What if I never passed middle school chemistry? I did, by the way.
my kids are in middle school right now, so I'm pretty familiar with the things that they're learning in middle school. And my middle schoolers can understand that if you add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, that the planet's going to warm. And scientists have understood this for a very long time.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. One place where there's an effort to go greener is in Anchorage. The administration of Mayor Ethan Berkowitz is moving forward on a new climate action plan and simultaneously pursuing measures to reduce the city's carbon emissions. The move comes at a time when cities and states are clashing with federal environmental policies and developing their own climate initiatives. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes wanted to find out how much a city like Anchorage can actually do to curb carbon emissions.
They got it. Let me see. Here you go.
Rafael Contreras is in the cab of his garbage truck, toggling a joystick to carefully pinch and lift a recycling bin with a massive hydraulic arm. Originally from the Dominican Republic, Contreras came to Alaska after a career playing professional baseball, but for the last 13 years, he's been driving garbage trucks, seeing and smelling a curious side of the city.
Oh yeah, some people, they throw, like, summertime, they like to throw a lot of fish carcass. I was very smelly.
The city-run garbage and recycling programs use a lot of energy, mostly in the form of fuel for the hulking 22-ton trucks that crawl up city streets and alleys. Contreras' truck gets, on average, just 2.5 miles to the gallon, which is pretty bad, unless you're Shana Kilcoin and your job is finding ways for municipal utilities to save money and energy.
One of the things that we're doing is looking at ways that we can electrify our fleet and save energy and save money for the municipality.
If you're a city like Anchorage, there's only so many resources you control that touch on energy issues. But one of the big ones is the fleet of cars, trucks, buses, snowplows, and yes, lumbering red garbage trucks. There's also road infrastructure more broadly, particularly since the sprawling municipality is such a car-centric city.
This is actually a big priority because over 50% of our emissions are coming from transportation in the city of Anchorage.
Kilcoin's job is to turn energy-related measures from policy proposals into practice. That means developing a lot of big-picture ideas on stuff like city planning, food systems, and renewable energy, and then finding practical ways to implement them. And this isn't always flashy. For example, a pilot program this winter is experimenting with electric trash trucks. The city is already testing eerily quiet electric buses. And so far, Kilcoin says Anchorage has upgraded 4,000 street lamps, changing the old high-pressure sodium lights to efficient new LEDs.
This is not a feel-good measure. LED lights use just a fraction of the energy that our regular incandescent bulbs or even CFLs use. And so it does make a big difference on a facility. We're seeing 40 to 50% savings on lighting upgrades.
But those 4,000 replaced represent only 1/10 of all the streetlights in town. Still, Kilcoin and the administration argue this isn't just about environmental protection. It's also good long-term fiscal policy. More efficient lights mean less energy is used, but also less money spent on labor to replace them. But there's only so much a local government can control, and it's not like the municipality is even close to the largest energy customer by any means. Its share of the total energy used in Anchorage? 4%. 5 if you include streetlights. And a clock is ticking. The climate's changing so rapidly that Kevin Kennedy, a senior fellow at the World Resource Institute, insists things are too dire to be picky.
Everyone needs to step up and do what they can.
Kennedy researches how states, the federal government, and businesses can all address carbon emissions. He says each unit, whether it's a city, a region, or an office building, has assets it uniquely controls. Cities, for example, can enforce greener building standards, waste management, and public transit systems. Typically, it's states or regions that have the ability to shift away from carbon-based energy sources. Kennedy says when he worked for the state of California, people would pessimistically point out that even if the whole state went to zero emissions overnight, globally, that's only 1 or 2% of what humans are pumping into the atmosphere.
But you can say that about everything. And if everyone says, oh, I'm not going to act because I don't know that everyone else is going to act, then nothing will happen.
In Kennedy's assessment, even if the municipality of Anchorage can only affect 4 or 5% of the city's total energy usage, a sliver of the global carbon load, the move is still meaningful. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state from Valdez, Anchorage, and more. Information at flyraven.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
After a roughly two-year court battle, a Superior Court judge ruled today that the Kenai Peninsula Borough's invocation policy is unconstitutional. The court case dates back to 2016 when the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly responded to an invocation led by Iris Fontana, one of the three plaintiffs in the case. The Assembly responded to Fontana's prayer that ended in the words, "Hail Satan," by implementing a policy that restricted the invocation to individuals and religious organizations on a pre-approved list. Soon after, the ACLU of Alaska sued the borough, arguing the policy violated Fontana and others' freedom of speech. However, the court only considered whether the policy violated the Alaska Constitution's Establishment Clause, which states that no law should establish an official religion in the state, and that no law should, quote, act as a step towards an official religion. The court found that the borough's policy excluded, quote unquote, minority faiths, and therefore is unconstitutional. KBBI reached out to the Kenai Peninsula Borough for comment, but did not hear back in time for this story. The Anchorage School Board yesterday voted against changing school start times for the district. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, board members expressed concern over how new times would impact staff, parents, and students.
The school board has been exploring a change to start times since March, pointing to studies that show high school and middle school students would benefit from later start times. The research suggested that increased sleep reduces depression and truancy and leads to an overall increase in academic performance. Board President Star Marcette recognized the validity of the research, but said she felt that the district has a lot of higher priority issues to address.
There's no doubt that there is research out there that says it is beneficial to high school students. I believe that now is not the right time, and I say that because there is so much going on in our school district right now and so many changes going on, and this impacts our staff and impacts our community, and if it impacts our staff and the community, it impacts our students.
The proposed memorandum would have had high school days start 30 minutes later. Elementary schools would start 15 minutes earlier and middle schools 75 minutes later. Board member Andy Holloman felt that the positive effects of changing the start times for high schoolers didn't justify the negative effects to the other schools.
They either dramatically disrupt things or they disrupt things a bit with no real gain coming.
The board voted 5-1 against the change. Board member Dina Mitchell was the sole yes vote. She thought that the benefits of increasing student sleep warranted later start times.
I really feel strongly that I would like to see us follow the research and create an environment that our 13 to 18 year olds, which includes the some of our older middle school students too, to allow them to be more successful.
The 7-member board only has 6 members currently. Betty Davis resigned last month. Board President Marcette says a new school board member will be in attendance at the next meeting scheduled for October 22nd. The newly appointed member would serve the remainder of Davis's term, which ends in April. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council has taken a step toward regulating unguided boats that anglers pay to use in order to fish for halibut. The council may require those boats to be registered and may also impose more restrictive charter bag limits on the customers that utilize them. KBBI's Aaron Bolton explains.
In recent years, the NPFMC has heard testimony about a perceived increase of unguided rental boats in the Gulf of Alaska and in Southeast Alaska. Many have argued that fishing lodges and charters have been using those boats to skirt more restrictive charter bag limits. Andy Mesro represents the charter sector on the council.
We have seen the guided sector to be very resourceful in creating business entities that are not guided in order to avoid restrictions built into the halibut catch sharing plan.
The NPFMC estimates that there are roughly 250 rental boats available in International Pacific Halibut Commission regulatory areas 2C, which embodies Southeast, and Area 3A, which covers the Central Gulf. Without a specific registration requirement for these boats, it's hard to know just how many there are, but catch data suggests there is a problem in Southeast.
The non-charter harvest has been declining and then moved up to equal to the charter harvest in 2011 to almost doubling by 2016. This growth, combined with written and public testimony about the influx of fleets of new for-hire vessels coming into communities, has given the council enough evidence of correlation that a problem exists.
The sport sector's harvest is subtracted from the total allowable catch before it's divvied between the charter and commercial sectors. Mesereau says an increase in sport harvest could reduce the available catch for those fisheries. Halibut stocks are on the decline, and Mesereau also raised conservation concerns in relation to the issue. The council asked its staff to analyze two tools that may help it better understand the potentially growing fleet of for-hire boats.
Defining all of these entities as one for-hire sector, creating a registration and aligning the bag limits with the guided sector, is a necessary action to understand and then manage this fleet.
The proposed regulations could require businesses that receive any kind of compensation for boats used for recreational halibut fishing to be registered in regulatory areas 2C and 3A. Another alternative could impose charter bag limits on anglers paying to use those vessels. Councilmember and Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton expressed concern about the measures potentially reducing Alaskans' access to the halibut resource, particularly those who can't afford a boat.
You know, you hear from the residents more often, and we know we can't distinguish between residents of Alaska and residents of another state in an action like this, but sometimes these regulations, any of the regulations we impose, have differential impacts on residents and non-residents.
Councilmember John Jensen, who owns a boat rental business in Petersburg, echoed Cotton. However, he says he supports the measure for now.
But hearing that there's conservation needs in the background here, I'm going to be supporting this for now and see where it goes.
The council also wants its staff to look into tracking how many halibut sport fishermen on for hire unguided boats reel in each year. However, it's unclear when the council will receive a final report and when it may take final action on the issue. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
There is a new champion fattest bear in Katmai. The winner of Katmai National Park's fourth annual Fat Bear Week is number 409. 409, also known as Bead Nose, advanced through this year's bracket because, as park staff put it, quote, her radiant rolls were deemed by the voting public to be this year's most fabulous flab. 409's prize? A good shot at surviving the winter. She will have a few more weeks to expand her already impressive figure before resting on her laurels, hopefully in a den for the winter. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.